LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Henry Reilly.
Morning, 4 minutes after 12 is the time. You're listening to Henry Reilly in for Ben Kentish on LBC. Continuing with the coverage of the state banquets, not only on James Max's programme at 1 o'clock, but as I say, Ian Dale will be joining us a little bit later on this hour to get his thoughts and to reflect on that speech that we led the programme with from King Charles. This hour, I want to talk about cohabiting. It's a topic that my colleague James O'Brien covered now yesterday, I suppose, on his programme. And it comes from an article in The Times where there's been a surge in people living together, requesting agreements as fewer people tie the knots while still own a home and they raise a family together. They're effectively in a similar relationship to a married couple. They just don't have the title of being married. And they have one particular example of Claire and Ashley, who've been together 6 years. They have two children, but no intention of getting married. A poll of more than 2,000 people found 60% believe that unmarried couples should have the same right as those who marry to leave assets to each other free of inheritance tax. 52%, over half, said cohabiting couples should be eligible for the rights enjoyed by married people within the first 5 years of living together. The government is expected to launch a spring consultation on reforming the law to strengthen cohabitation rights. My question to you this hour is, and if you're one of them, great. If not, and you want to put the opposite view, then equally great. Why did you feel so strongly that you wanted to get married? Why are fewer people tying the knot? 0345 6060 973. If you do cohabit, why are you put off by the idea of a wedding? Are you put off by the constraints of marriage? Maybe not necessarily financial, or maybe it is financial, but more the sort of pressure of being with someone and having that label as being married. Why are fewer people getting married? Why are you choosing to cohabit? 0345 6060 973. We're getting to your views on that in a moment. First, though, joined by Neil Russell, who's partner and head of family at Seddon's GSC, who joins me now. For people who are considering this and for who are just cohabiting, why don't they just get married?
Oh, that's the question one ought to ask those that don't.
Yeah.
Some people have the view that they don't want to get married. There is the other alternative of a civil partnership, which means you're not married, but you have a civil partnership, and it provides the civil partners the same rights and remedies that a divorcing couple will have, and provide the same provision on death by way of inheritance. So there is an alternative to marriage, and that's a civil partnership. Originally, civil partnerships came about for same-sex couples when you couldn't have a marriage for same-sex couples, so they had civil partnerships, and then that was opened up not just to same-sex couples but to men and women.
This poll that's being cited here found 60% of the cohabiting couples who were asked believed that unmarried couples should have the same right as those who marry to leave assets to each other free of inheritance tax. Clearly the benefits of getting married in that field outweigh not getting married. What do you make of their sort of demands or what they're seeking?
You know, simplistically, it's understandable. You live with someone for 20 years, you have a family together, not in the marriage sense, but, you know, have children, and then you want to provide for each other on death. You can. The only problem is inheritance tax applies and you don't have the spousal exemptions. So, you know, you have the right to change the status of your relationship, to become a civil partnership or to be a married couple. So the law is there if you just choose the other options. But because of the growing number of people who are in cohabiting rather than marriages, the Parliament is looking to perhaps introduce reforms. There was 1.5 million cohabiting couples in 1996, and that's moved to more than 3.6 million in 2021. And that number is ever growing. And the biggest problem with that is the common law myth that people are married. Sorry, not that they're married, that they have the same rights as married couples.
Right. And of the reasons that are often cited, I hear that people are stressed out with weddings, not just the price of it, but the whole stress of putting it on in the first place. They, perhaps some people want to be a bit freer in terms of their sort of openness of their relationship. People like the idea of financially saving whilst sort of not everything is put in an equal pot. Are those the sort of reasons that we still get for people not wanting to get married?
Yeah, some people are also worried about the pressure that the marriage label itself and getting prepared for marriage will have on their relationship. So they think they're better off staying as they are in a cohabiting relationship rather than marriage. I mean, there's a multitude of reasons, but, you know, we can elect what we want to do in all sorts of areas. But, you know, if you want to drive, you've got to have a driving license. Arguably, if you want to have the safeguards of marriage, you need to have a marriage and or a civil partnership. But I think that the biggest problem for people is they fail to appreciate that if you're not married, you don't have the same rights and remedies available to you. One of the interesting things I hadn't realised myself, that in the new proposals, they're talking about, never mind reform, if we ever get there, but educational changes. And I've read somewhere that from September 2026, statutory RSC guidance will teach in schools that common law marriage is a myth, which I thought was quite remarkable.
Really?
Yes, you shared the same surprise as I had when I read that.
So that will be, and what will be the implications of that, do you think, Neil?
I think it will encourage people to not stay as a cohabitee, but to get married. And so let us take, whether you're very rich or not so rich, one person owns the home, the other person moves in, you then have children together, but you're not married. The person who owns the home does not necessarily lose a share of their home to the non-property owner. The only way the non-property owner will be able to advance an argument for an interest in that property if they can demonstrate a legal contribution or a clear common intention that an interest has been granted. Now, it's not easy to do that in many cases. What a lot of people do these days, if they want to remain as cohabitees rather than married or civil partnerships, is they enter into cohabitation agreements, which is an agreement which provides for what may happen or what may not happen in the event of a breakdown of a relationship.
Right. And those, what's the similarity between those cohabitation agreements and what we understand as marriage?
Well, there are many, many differences.
Yeah.
For a start, the spouse in a marriage will have a right to financial support on the breakdown of marriage, a right to a sharing principle. We have a statutory framework that sets out the guidelines that the court takes into account in determining what the distribution of assets should be on the breakdown of a marriage, which was dated back in 1973, so 50 years later we're still using the same statute, but we had a big change, a seismic change in the year 2000 with a case of White and White, which provides for the starting point for divorcees to have equality unless there's good reason to depart, and then you go back to the 1973 Act. So what we've got is provisions for marriage, but no provisions at the moment for the end of a cohabiting relationship or the death of a partner.
Right. And the institution of marriage, which we often speak about on LBC, and I certainly notice a trend with younger people who say, well, we're sort of not sure at this age whether we want to get married, and they do end up getting married in a lot of cases, but people are very sceptical at a younger age, and they think in some ways it's sort of an outdated concept. Has that always been the case, Neil? Am I being a bit of an old fogey, or are we seeing more of that?
We can speak about what we read, or we can speak about our experiences. And I've been practicing family law for over 30 years. And what I've seen more of than ever is people coming to us for prenuptial or postnuptial agreements. And that's not just those who are getting married for the second time when they want to provide for their children or they're bringing big wealth to the relationship, but younger people who have had some help, let's say, from the bank of mum and dad to buy a property and they want to protect that, and or to protect other assets that they have before the marriage. So I think people are wising up to the financial safeguards that they need to take generally. And for some people, they won't get married because they don't want to. A prenuptial agreement is not certain. It is a very weight-bearing and heavy factor these days since the case of Radmacher and Gratitino in 2010. So for nearly 16 years, prenuptial agreements have had a growing and growing precedence in the English courts. But they cannot exclude the English courts' jurisdiction. So if the prenuptial agreement doesn't provide for what's fair, then the English courts may not uphold it. But there is more education about prenuptial agreements these days. So people who would not otherwise get married because of a fear of losing everything they've got, they're shifting towards, well, hang on a minute, I still want to get married, but I want to protect what I have, and we can.
And how watertight is that prenup then? Because if you are still worried about, say there is a huge imbalance, which, I mean, you'll see a lot of this, I imagine, but there's a huge imbalance in terms of your sort of monetary position and your financial stability. You know, to put it bluntly, one person is quite rich, the other person may not necessarily be. Does the prenup, will that definitely cover the person who is better off?
If they're dealt with properly, there are certain criteria that one needs to address. Both parties should be independently legally advised.
Yeah.
Both parties should be freely and voluntarily entering into the agreement. It should be executed as a deed, which means it needs to be witnessed and drawn up in a particular form. Both parties need to make full financial disclosure so that you understand what you're giving up and what you're seeking to protect. And ideally, it needs to be fair. So if you're a multimillionaire and you provide nothing for your spouse in the event of divorce, that won't be upheld by the court. And ideally, it should also be signed up at least 28 days before the marriage. Now, the other thing that we see these days are postnuptial agreements, which are dealt with during the marriage. That's why it's called a postnup. And that might often be required where parents are making lifetime gifts to their children and or they want to help their children, and they're concerned that the children's marriage may come into difficulty and they don't want that asset or that gift to be shared. So
I've actually never heard of that. So does that, do they have to know? No, I take it they don't, as in the children.
No. The parents say to the child, for example, we're making lifetime provision for you because we're concerned about our inheritance tax. So we want to start tax planning. And so we want to give you, you know, let's just call it £1 million. But we want that to remain with you and or your children. In the event of divorce, we don't want it to be shared on the divorce.
Right. Oh, I see.
So they might make a condition precedent of that gift that their child enters into a postnuptial agreement, and then we would record that postnuptial gift as being separate property that in the event of divorce would not be the subject of what we call the sharing principle, because matrimonial assets get shared. So you're saying it's not a matrimonial asset, it's separate, and it won't be subject to the sharing principle.
Given that we've seen this huge increase in the number of people who are cohabiting and not necessarily married and therefore don't have those wedded rights, do you think we're going to see lawmakers have to catch up, basically, to change things?
I think Parliament has its responsibility to look out for us to the extent that it should. And what it's recognising is that there's a growth of cohabitees, and therefore they're knocking at the door for reform to accommodate the cohabitees. But then they're talking about, in terms of what may happen, you've got to be in a cohabiting relationship. The smallest number I've seen is 2 years, and the range is 2 to 5 years. But what I'm not clear about is how are people going to register? Because, you know, we don't automatically start by saying, hi, we're living together, let's just make a note of the date. So we've been living together from the 28th of April 2026. people move in slowly, so it's hard to define what cohabitation is. Many people share properties together. They each have their own and they might spend time with each other. Does that amount to cohabitation? If I move in and I still have my shirts and suits in one property, but I have my weekend clothes in another, am I cohabiting? You know, we're going to have a definition of what cohabitation means. We're going to need to have a date from which it begins. I don't know how they're going to formalise those points.
Thank you, Neil. Neil Russell is partner and head of family at Seddon's GSC. Your experiences in a moment. Why are you not tying the knot?